Okay, folks, we're going to start up now. Trying to make certain that each of these lectures begins exactly on time. Can everybody hear me all right in this hall? Relatively all right. Okay, my name is Will Seaman. I'm a volunteer with the Wisconsin Union Directorate Student Lectures Committee. And I'd like to welcome you to the third lecture of the 1989-90 Distinguished Lectures series. I'd like to begin by introducing our interpreter for this evening, Ms. Sharon Matuszewski. As we were unable to arrange for two interpreters for today's lecture, Sharon will be taking on quite a difficult task tonight. Simultaneous interpreting, as I'm sure I need hardly say, is quite exhausting. We'll be taking a brief but necessary break in between the lecture and question and answer session. And we thank you in advance for your patience, and we're especially grateful for Sharon agreeing to work this lecture on her own. As you can see also, we are videotaping and audiotaping this evening. I apologize for the obstructions. We're going to be rebroadcasting each of the lectures from the Distinguished Lectures series this year on public access cable TV, WYOU, here in Madison. And if you take out some paper and something to write with, I'll give you some air dates very quickly here. Seymour Melman is going to be aired November 2nd, Thursday at 8:30 p.m. All of these are on Thursdays at 8:30 p.m. Angela Davis, who spoke here last week, Thursday, November 9th and Thursday, November 30th at 8:30 p.m. Tonight's lecture will be rebroadcast November 16th at 8:30. And Francis Moore LePay, who's going to be speaking here November 15th, we have a couple air dates, November 23rd and 28th at 8:30 p.m. Now, before introducing this evening's speaker, I have to say a little bit about the Union Directorate Student Lectures Committee. The organization that is sponsoring the Distinguished Lectures Series and is also making the video rebroadcast possible. The Wisconsin Union Directorate Student Lectures Committee is funded by student segregated fees. Participation in the committee programming is open to all University of Wisconsin students. If you're interested in working with the committee, or if you have any questions regarding this or other lecture programs, please give us a call at 262-2214 or drop by our offices at 514 Memorial Union. That's just upstairs from here on the fifth floor. This is the third lecture of the 89-90 Distinguished Lecture Series. Last week we hosted with the Black Law Student Association, Ms. Angela Davis, and next month, Wednesday, as I said, November 15th, we're welcoming Ms. Frances Moore LePay, who will be delivering an evening lecture and also, like this evening's speaker, will be conducting a seminar the following day. And on Valentine's Day, February 14th, the Lectures Committee is very pleased to present an evening with the world-renowned author, Ms. Maya Angelou. And finally, March 28th, the series ends with two lectures presented by Daniel Ellsberg. Now, finally, I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker. Edward Said was born in Jerusalem, Palestine, and attended lower and secondary schools there and in Egypt. He received his BA from Princeton and his MA and PhD from Harvard. Professor Said's work has been translated into 8 languages and published throughout Europe, Africa, Asia, and Australia. His book, Beginnings, Intention, and Method, won the first annual Lionel Trilling Award given at Columbia University. In 1978, his book, Orientalism, was runner-up in the criticism category of the National Book Critics Circle Award. His other books include Literature and Society, which he edited, The Question of Palestine, Covering Islam, The World, the Text, and the Critic, and Blaming the Victims, co-edited with Christopher Hitchens. Professor Said is at present Old Dominion Foundation Professor in the Humanities and chairs the doctoral program in comparative literature at Columbia University. He is currently a member of the Palestine National Council and was active in discussions leading to the decision of the United States to begin talks with the PLO. A Palestinian by birth and a member of the Palestine National Council, Professor Said has written extensively on all manner of topics surrounding events in the Middle East. It is perhaps too obvious to note that feelings tend to run rather high on these topics, and it seems reasonable to expect that even after Professor Said's lecture this evening, There will be some of you with some lingering doubts and questions, perhaps even some criticism that you'd like to voice. There will be an ample opportunity for questions and comments during the discussion period that will follow the lecture. This evening's lecture is titled The Palestinian Peace Initiative. On behalf of the Student Lectures Committee, I would like to now introduce Professor Edward Said.
Very pleased to be here tonight. I have a terrible flu. I'm unable to hear myself think and or speak, so I hope you'll bear with me as I make my way through what I consider to be an important and I hope interesting topic. I'd like to, before I begin, I'd like to say something very quickly about the justifiable national press attention to the University of Wisconsin recently on the matter of the so-called, I think, sister university project, by which the university, through the student government, as I understand it, has affiliated itself with a Palestinian university on the occupied West Bank, Al-Najah University, which is, of course, closed by the occupation authorities. I want to publicly register my respect and admiration for what is a significant and important gesture, I take it to be again, students always lead the way in these things. I take it to be a sign of the times that there is now increasing recognition on American campuses and elsewhere in the country of the justice of the Palestinian cause. So, once again, I'd like to say, well done and press on. It seems to me overdue. Now, I think it's true to say that modern history teaches us that whenever there's a complex social and political struggle, it is often those who are the victims of that struggle who come forth with a creative solution to the struggle. I think this is eminently true of the Palestinian people at this moment. We are the ones who have proposed a daring and sweeping peace initiative that forecasts a peaceful settlement to the almost 100-year-old conflict between Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs. I want to speak about this initiative tonight, but I want both to put it in the historical context from which it emerges, and no less urgently, I want to contrast it in its far-reaching vision with the terrible sufferings today of the Palestinians who live under Israeli military occupation on the West Bank and Gaza. Territories that were conquered in 1967 and have been ruled with increasing brutality and cruelty ever since. It thus becomes imperative for me to speak also about the Palestinian uprising, or Intifada, which began in December of 1987 and continues until the present, unabated, unbowed, hopeful. And then I should like to speak also about the very important role played both in the conflict and in the struggle for peace by the United States, which is Israel's main supporter in the world today, some would say its only supporter in the world today, and which, in my opinion, is responsible directly and indirectly for impeding the likelihood of a political settlement to the conflict between Palestinian Arabs and Israeli Jews. Now, this isn't entirely a matter of administrations, although the Reagan administration was spectacularly bad, having increased levels of U.S. aid to Israel to unimaginable heights, thereby producing a string of catastrophes for the Palestinian people and an unbroken sequence of Israeli actions stemming from arrogance, intransigence, and almost unbelievable to someone who stands on the other side, actions of almost unbelievable mindlessness and short-sightedness. It is also a matter of the extraordinary role played in the United States by the media and by public discourse, both of which have always favored the Israeli point of view, partly because the Israeli lobby, which is more powerful and more wealthy than almost any other foreign policy pressure group, continues efficiently and, in my opinion, also heedlessly. But there are other and a number of very hopeful changes taking place now, and I shall be pointing them out as I go along, that is to say, changes taking place within the United States. Finally, I want to say tonight that ignorance of the facts, and perhaps this is the main point I'll be making tonight, ignorance of the facts and the issues for Americans who have contributed and continue to contribute so much to Israel. Ignorance of the facts and the issues is no excuse for us in the United States. We are a party to the conflict, and we must face up to the responsibility of our involvement and of our immense influence, both with Israel, which has been benefited from us for four decades, and because of our influence with the Arab world, which has not benefited. I've often heard Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg, who's a prominent historian and intellectual who has been very vocal in criticism of Israel recently. He happens to be a one-time colleague of mine at Columbia. I've often heard Hertzberg say that for American Jews, the cause of Israel is a sort of secular religion. As if to corroborate this, in his recent book on his stints as a reporter in Beirut and Jerusalem, New York Times correspondent Tom Friedman, who he tells us in the book grew up in Minneapolis, documents aspects of the extraordinary importance that post-1967 Israel has had for the intellectual and cultural formation of young Jews of his generation. Pride, cultural identification with Israel as a robust state, and a renewed interest in Hebrew and the Jewish past. Since the beginning of the Palestinian uprising, however, there has been a change in Israel's status among American Jews. To the small number of us, Palestinians, in the United States, this change has been quite evident, for example, in the new troubled perception of Israel's unresolved difficulties over the occupied territories, and these now are quite visible within the American Jewish world, as well as evident in the treatment, in the trouble caused to a number of American Jews by the treatment of Palestinians by Israeli military and settlers, as well also as the whole concept of a democratic Jewish state in what is still an Arab, largely inhospitable Arab and Islamic environment. To talk about American Jews as a group is, of course, to assume that a large number of individuals is more homogeneous and coherent than it really is. Certainly, as I've said, and this is to me a sign of great hope, there are the serious differences that have enabled some intellectuals, now increasing, I think, in number, openly to discuss peace and reconciliation with Palestinians, and, on the other hand, the other Jewish intellectuals, for example, Irving Kristol, in a piece that he wrote for the Wall Street Journal of July the 21st, the title of his piece is, "Who Needs Peace in the Middle East?" And his line is, "We, certainly Israel doesn't need peace." or a piece in the New York Times by Norman Podhoretz, equally luminous in its logic, October the 22nd. Israel, he says, isn't suicidal. That's the title of his piece. Therefore, it shouldn't sign any peace with the Arabs. These kinds of things summarize the stonewalling attitude of people who want the appalling status quo to change as little as possible. In fact, both Kristol and Podhoretz, who are influential right-wing, in the case of Podhoretz, I suppose to say right-wing is slightly charitable. He's off the scale entirely. But anyway, he says that it's better for... He explicitly says that it's better for Palestinians to continue being beaten up and all the rest of it than for anything to change, because any change would mean that Israel was committing suicide. Nevertheless, I think I'm right in believing that for American Jewish individuals, as well as the various camps into which they are divided, the fact of Israel today in late 1989 is a strong theme and a common concern at a time when, in the name of the Jewish people, Israel is engaged in a battle with the Palestinian people, a conflict whose course, I am convinced, American Jews and non-Jews can definitely influence, if not determine. At no time in the century-old conflict between Palestinians and Jews has the struggle over land, national rights, and political destiny been sharper or more critical than it is today. For Palestinians, this has been, in the last 2 years, the most momentous period in our post-war history. There has been the generally non-lethal and principled resistance against occupation of the uprising or intifada itself. There have been the many seismic changes in the Palestinian social body since the intifada began, the dramatic improvement and change in the condition of women, the greater coherence in political vision, the tremendous increase in self-esteem that has accompanied the banishment of fear, the inspiring mobilization of Palestinian resources in aid of the Intifada at a time when we had almost gotten used to indifference, the indifference of others, in dealing with the question of Palestine. Above all, for Palestinians, there has been the historical compromise achieved at the Algiers Palestine National Council meeting in mid-November of 1988. At that meeting was charted the political ground for what transpired even more explicitly thereafter, and I'm thinking here of the speeches at the UN in Geneva of Yasser Arafat in December. The essence of this peace initiative was that there was to be a resolved partition of mandatory Palestine, historical Palestine, into two states, the acceptance of UN resolutions 242 and 338, the renunciation of terrorism, and most important, although it had been part of the Palestinian program for several years, a formal undertaking to end the conflict by political negotiation and not by violence. Now, the importance of this, I want to state right here, is that it was done by the mainstream, by the majority of the Palestinian people, who are, as you all know, without any doubt, in a state of dispersion. There are the Palestinians who live on the West Bank and Gaza under Israeli occupation, the Palestinians who remained within Israel. There are the Palestinians who live in various parts of the Arab world, principally Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and elsewhere. And there are the smaller number of Palestinians who live in the West and the East, all of whom constitute a nation. It is on behalf of all of this group, with the input of this entire group of roughly 5 million people, that the PNC produced the program I've just described. And it's the centrality of this, the fact that it came out of, it emanated from the majority Palestinian position, that gives it its importance and puts it, of course, in stark contrast with the current Israeli position, which, as symbolized by the government of Mr. Shamir, is still unable even to resolve the question of elections, which an initiative such as it was, which it itself proposed. But to return now to the Palestinian dimension, some of these elements in the peace initiative that I've just described can be rendered more concretely. Their profoundly significant and difficult meaning for many Palestinians given a human content if I translate them into the material of my own experience. Like most of the Palestinians who belong to the so-called exile community, I am not from the West Bank or Gaza. I was born in West Jerusalem in a family home, not a hospital. A family home now, I'm told, occupied by European Jewish family or families. My mother was born in Nazareth and grew up there and in the town of Safed, which have both Nazareth and Safed have been towns inside Israel since 1948. I have had an extravagantly fortunate life, but literally every single member of my family has been a refugee, adversely and in several cases catastrophically affected by the loss of property, citizenship, and political rights attendant upon the destruction of Palestinian society in 1948, which is the year, of course, that Israel was established. One member of my extended family lost his life violently because of the conflict. Now, that the Palestine National Council could solemnly accept a state not only in less than 25% of former Palestine, but also in that part of land precisely for most of us not our native area, is therefore a major sacrifice of considerable magnitude. When Jews speak of Israel as a place they come home to, you must allow, and this is extremely important for those of you who are neither Palestinian nor Jewish, but certainly very important for Jews to understand, I think. When Israel is spoken of as a place that Jews can come home to, you must allow that the word home to Palestinian ears has a death-like effect. I do not minimize what for Jews is an age-old problem of persecuted and even genocidal alienation and exile, but one must also understand the wounding immediacy for Palestinians of quite literally witnessing our home turned into someone else's home, country, and state, even as the number of Palestinian dead, shot, beaten, asphyxiated by Israel for the last 5 decades continues to increase and is now in the uncounted thousands. I can perhaps give you another example of the drama of this irony by which the repatriation of Jews means something the opposite for us. Take now the issue of Soviet Jews who are going to be given visas to leave the Soviet Union with a proviso. I'm cutting through a lot of the detail here, with the proviso that they go now only to Israel. The Israeli government has made it clear that most of these new Soviet immigrants to Israel, who are not going to be given the choice of going elsewhere, will be settled on the West Bank and Gaza. This further increases the number of Palestinians, obviously, whose lands are going to be expropriated and makes it more difficult for Palestinians to have a sovereign national existence. So that this type of coincidence has to be underlined, as we recall that during the Intifada alone, the toll as of October the 22nd, my figures are 4 days old, the toll of Palestinian dead has gone beyond 780 people. So what was decided at the Algiers National Council meetings, therefore, has an import little short of national self-denial, done consciously, and I would want to insist, courageously, in the interests of peace and a measure of justice for a deprived, much aggrieved, and suffering nation of Palestinians. Palestinians of my generation knew Palestine as a predominantly Arab country, albeit one held by the British during the mandatory period until 1948, and, to us, gradually infiltrated by European Jews who seemed to be coming to a land they knew principally via religion and ideology. The sudden cataclysmic rupture in 1948, whereby a land and home that were once ours were declared to be the Jewish state of Israel, cannot be contemptuously dismissed, since its definitiveness affected every single Palestinian. These are facts, and they require understanding no less than the understanding of their past that Jews have understandably required from the world. I don't say that the facts shouldn't be interpreted. I only say that the facts shouldn't be interpreted away. Yet I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that with only the small number of exceptions that I referred to earlier, American Jewish support for Israel from 1948 on, and especially after 1967, has been tied to a dehumanization, dismissal, and after the mid-1970s, a demonization of the Palestinian people. The truth is what is important here, not a settling of scores nor a bill of particulars. It is true to begin with that as Arabs, Muslims, non-Westerners, we have never had access to, nor did we completely master, the political and cultural discourse of Europe and America. Thus, during the post-1948 period, Arabs emerged in the media and public discourse only as faceless creatures, murderers, terrorists, enemies of civilization, subject to a whole array of unattractive and automatically and ceaselessly repeated deformations. One would often encounter descriptions of the Arabs as a mass, as irrational, fanatical, misanthropic, barbaric, despotic, etc. Always it was our negative features that allowed Israel's intellectual apologists to set us off against, in order then to underscore, Israeli liberalism, democracy, and enlightenment. And everyone here can testify to this. Israel is a democracy. And this always means, in the argument, that the opponents of Israel and the people who don't support Israel necessarily are the enemies of democracy, the enemy of civilization, and so on and so forth. And I need to add quickly, the dehumanization of Palestinians occurred as an extension to the already quite formidable battery of measures taken by Israel from 1948 on to erase most of our presence from our native land. And this is very similar to what happened to Native Americans. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, roughly 800,000, were made refugees in 1948. Over 400 Palestinians villages were destroyed. Endless internal wars and punishing military as well as civil measures by which land was expropriated, by which, in effect, Palestinians were made into, although Israelis, were made into second-class citizens, no more and no less dramatic than being identified as non-Jews in a society that tabulated everything according to, on the one hand, the Jews and the non-Jews on the other, a form of discrimination which one ought to ponder. By the middle of 1967, that is to say after the June 67 war, the entirety of historical Palestine was placed under Israeli rule. You will surely have read or heard about the work of some recent Israeli historians like Benny Morris and Tom Segev, Simcha Flapan, and one or two others, whose reconstructions of the ravages of 1948 and after mostly coincide with a testimony of Palestinian words and voices that were never heard in the United States. Not heard because unpublished and undisseminated in the media here. Here where, as several critics have shown in detail, fear of the Israeli lobby or outright suppression determined that our story, our reality as Palestinians, our deprivations were to be given no outlet, allowed no significant space. That this corresponded exactly with the blindness of the Zionist pioneers who came to Palestine and ignored or overlooked the presence there of another people is only part of the story. The other part is even more unattractive. The overt attacks in this country upon everything to do with Palestinians and as Arabs, And even, I might add, their arithmetical claims to human existence. I refer here, for example, to a book by Joan Peters a couple of years ago, which tried to prove by enormous, ultimately fraudulent tabulations, that the Palestinians didn't exist. And I recall, for example, as a graduate student, hearing, and or rather seeing in this instant, this was back in the early 60s, Jerry Lewis on television in one of these, you know, sort of foppish, coy moments of his, when he would get angry at somebody and do this, he would insult them and say, "You Arab!" That was the ultimate insult. I could list many more names than the ones I've mentioned, Leon Uris and so on and so forth, or I could refer to the ugly racist parodies of Palestinian history that have appeared in magazines like Commentary and the New Republic and Midstream. But the point is clear enough. That is to say, with the conquest of the land and the settlement of it, went necessarily, apparently, now looking back on it, this campaign to obliterate the humanity and, above all, even the presence of the Palestinians, who were declared non-people. After 1967, but emphatically after the 1973 war, when America became Israel's mainstay, the rhetorical, discursive, and ideological reduction, as well as the invalidation of the Palestinian experience to a couple of dreadful clichés like terrorism and fanaticism, and now the new one is fundamentalism, they became more important than ever. Huge amounts of money, and this is very important to note, huge amounts of money and arms, roughly of the order of somewhere between $55 and $60 billion, went to Israel. At the UN, at the United Nations, in this period after 73 and on, every just or unjust criticism of Israel was blocked, not always successfully, by the United States. And let me give you two examples of what I consider to be the moral bankruptcy of U.S. support, political support for Israel in the United Nations, that boggles the mind. One was in the summer of 1982, when the Security Council was discussing the Israeli siege of Beirut. You'll recall that somewhere between 60 and 80,000 Israeli troops had surrounded the city of Beirut and were preventing supplies from coming in. The Security Council passed a resolution, or tried to pass a resolution, enjoining the Israeli besiegers to let through medical supplies. This was vetoed by the United States. And then again, in the summer of 1989, the United Nations, and also the Security Council, a very mild-mannered and very carefully toned-down resolution, enjoined again Israel to respect the rights, the human rights, of those Palestinian citizens under its jurisdiction, roughly 1.8 million. This, too, was vetoed by the United States. In both instances, just for the record, if you're interested, in both instances, the U.S. explanation of vote was that the resolution was unbalanced. Now, of course, the question is, if there was a Palestinian siege of an Israeli city, and that was not mentioned in the same breath as the Israeli siege of Beirut, then you could say it was unbalanced. Similarly, if there was a large population of Israeli civilians ruled by an army of Palestinians and that their rights were not being noted, that could also be thought of as unbalanced. But in this instance, where those situations are not obtained, I was going to say comic, but it's horrendous to use a phrase like unbalanced. Almost without exception, United States politicians have learned the art of ignoring the truth. Such inconvenient things that were frequently written about in the papers and available to anybody who cared to look, as the bombing of refugee camps, or the daringly lawless behavior of Israeli troops towards unarmed Palestinian civilians, the expropriations, the censorships, the preventive detentions, the expulsions, the torture, the demolition of houses, the unending killings that have gone on in the last 2 years. American politicians have ignored all of this, by and large. And at the same time, they have placated the pro-Israeli lobby with more financial aid and more praise for Israel, more anxiety about what is good for Israel, regardless of how bad it might be, not just for Palestinians, but for Americans as well. A particularly unpleasant intellectual gambit emerged among liberals, Jews and non-Jews. This is particularly noted, by the way, during the last part of the Vietnam War and thereafter, for whom anti-war, human rights, anti-imperial, and anti-nuclear causes were justifiably current. They were very active in those causes, yet who either explicitly or implicitly exempted Israel from mention. Somehow, in other words, if you were against the abuse of civil rights in South Africa or in Latin America or in the Soviet Union, or, you know, somehow you didn't get around to noting exactly the same kind of thing that was taking place in Israel. Because somehow the norms governing criticism of regimes who imprisoned people unjustly or who discriminated against citizens for reasons of race or religion or who mocked international law or who engaged in acts of piracy, collective punishment, and censorship, or who refused even to abide by conventions on nuclear non-proliferations, all these were condoned or judgment was suspended most of the times that Israel was concerned. And as cruel Israeli policies without a shred of magnanimity or compassion, this was the period when in the late 70s and continuing into the early 80s, the phrase Israel's benign occupation kept turning up. As cruel Israeli policies were routinized as far as the Palestinian people were concerned, so too did many American intellectuals and politicians habitually accept these abuses as required for Israeli security. I mean, you can see this, for example, in the editorials in the New York Times by William Safire and A. M. Rosenthal. That is to say that it would be all right if you condemned apartheid in South Africa, but somehow apartheid on the West Bank and Gaza was okay because it somehow needed to be in place for Israel's security. Toughness of heart and mind became the order of the day. What has always been sensationally eccentric about even the most cultivated intellectual justifications of Israel's behavior was that such justifications ignored or refused to consult the plentiful evidence available. These are matters documented by the Israeli and, generally speaking, the world press. And I want to make the argument here that none of what I'm going to say is even vaguely controversial. It is plentifully documented in, as I said, the Israeli press, but in most of the European and the rest of the world press. When a Syrian airliner was hijacked, of course people forget, when a Syrian airliner was hijacked by the Israelis in December of 1954 for the express purpose of hostage taking, it was done publicly, openly, unashamedly. When houses are blown up, or doctors, priests, or university presidents are expelled, as they have been on a daily basis from the West Bank and Gaza since 1967, or hundreds of books banned on the West Bank and Gaza. By the way, the very same people who objected, as I did too, when Salman Rushdie's book was banned and when there was a death threat put out against him, we all, it was our duty as intellectuals and writers to oppose this. But at the time, I remember noting, I said, it's good to do this for Salman, but what about all the number of writers and journalists and the books that have been banned and forbidden, etc., on the West Bank? There are hundreds of books, and the lists, they've been written about. Very few of the same people who defended Salman because he was being attacked by Islam wanted to note what Israel was doing in this instance. These facts, and it's not because they're not known, they're published in Israel's official journals, to say nothing of the Israeli daily press. And one thing I want to note here in parenthetically, is that the Israeli press, so far as Palestinians are concerned, is much more complete and fair, despite many of its political attitudes, than, say, the American press. But my problem is that I can't understand how raw, naked evidence that you've seen on television, all of you in this room, of people being beaten up, can be overridden in the United States just because some vague notion about Israel's security demands it. But it is overridden or hidden, no matter how overpoweringly cruel, no matter how inhuman and barbaric, no matter how loudly Israel proclaims what it is doing. I mean, when Rabin said, beatings, force, more beatings, he didn't hide it. He just said, this is our policy. And then the streams of apology that began to appear in this country by the supporters of Israel, saying, well, it was all part of Israeli security. To bomb a hospital, to use napalm against civilians, to require, as frequently happens today in the occupied territories, to require Palestinian men and boys to crawl or bark or scream, Arafat is a whore's son, to break the arms and legs of children, to confine people in desert detention camps without adequate space, sanitation, water, or legal charge, to use tear gas in school, to slap women as a matter of policy on the West Bank and Gaza. This is a recent invention, if you like, or refinement of Israeli policy that has been written about copiously in the Israeli daily press, how soldiers now employ the brutalizing women because they fear that if they don't do that, they will become insightful. Poisoning the grapes on the West Bank and Gaza. Or, to take the most extraordinary example, which has yet to get an editorial note from some of our most distinguished daily papers, the ordeal of the small town, which is southeast of Bethlehem on the West Bank, of Beit Sahur, which for over 6 weeks has been engaged in a contest of wills with the Israeli army. It's worth stopping a moment to tell you about this if you haven't seen it or heard about it or read about it. A small West Bank town decided quite on its own to undertake a tax revolt, to refuse to pay taxes to the Israeli military. You can understand that the citizens of the West Bank and Gaza have no civic rights, whatever. They have no representation. They're not entitled to know where, if they pay taxes, their tax money is going. For all they know, they may be paying taxes that end up in Israeli settlements on the West Bank and Gaza. And with the escalating cost of strikes, closed schools, closed shops, the burden of paying taxes to an illegal military occupation was too great. So this town decided to withhold taxes. Publicly that he's going to break the town. And this has resulted in a series of measures which have been publicly broadcast all over the world, but with very little attention in this country, by which the town has been curfewed. People's properties have been removed from their houses. Some people say between $2 and $5 million have been just simply taken out, confiscated by Israeli soldiers. Several houses have been destroyed. And the telephone and electricity has been cut, so that the contest is a contest not simply to get taxes, but to destroy Beit Sahur through the Israeli military. And we're talking about 8,000 or 9,000 civilians defying, because they have the will to do so, the Israeli military. All of these are horrific acts, whether they are part of a war against terrorism or the requirements of security. Not to note them, not to remember them, not to say, wait a moment. Can such acts as the siege of Beit Sahur, the slapping of women, the killing of 782 people, the asphyxiation, the detention centers, the curfews, the closing of schools and universities, can all of these be necessary for the sake of the Jewish people? Not to ask that question, it is inexplicable, but it is also to be complicit in these acts. The self-imposed silence of people who possess, in other cases and for other countries, supremely fine critical faculties is stunning. One still, and I say still with some incredulity, one still hears exonerations of Israeli practices that employ phrases like, and I quote, Israel's special vulnerability to terror against civilians, or, quote again, Israel is a democracy surrounded by totalitarian enemies sworn to destroy it. I suppose that these apocalyptic notions underwrite at least some of the silence. But here it would seem some tiny attention to truth, to reality, to history and rationality might dispel such notions as little short of grotesque. Every Arab state of consequence has accepted UN Resolution 242 for over two decades. For at least a decade, until recently, with some humanly understandable ambiguity, the Palestinian position has been to partition Palestine into two states. So the question is, where in fact is the alleged evidence for, quote, Arab states sworn to destroy Israel? It just doesn't exist. But even if it did, is there no proportionality, no symmetry between oaths swearing to destroy, on the one hand, and on the other, the obdurate, systematic oppression for four decades of precisely those people dispossessed and displaced by Israel in the first place? As for terrorism, that lumbering ideological Trojan horse, we must at last open our eyes to the massive harm done in the name of opposing it, so far as hostility to Palestinian self-determination is concerned. The bodies are there to be counted. Thousands of Palestinians, over and above the massacres of 1948 and the invasion of Lebanon in 1982, the attempted starvation of whole towns and camps in Gaza and the West Bank, versus the relative handful of Israeli fatalities, all of them, however, the results of practices that are, and I say it without any difficulty at all, practices that are shocking and condemnable. But we must take into account the huge proportion of Palestinian deaths. Are we to assume that as Palestinians, our deaths and sufferings count for 100 times less than those of real people, like Americans or Israelis? Nor is this all. When in a relatively few instances the facts do get through, for example, the important media coverage of the Palestinian Intifada that occurred during the early part of during 1988 and the early part of 1989, attempts at suppression occur. Who could forget? Who could forget the formidable moral intelligence of Henry Kissinger, advising American Jews, or the leaders of the American Jewish community, to ban the press, South Africa style, or, no less, in my opinion, shameful, Joseph Papp, the director of the Public Theater in New York, canceling a Palestinian theater company's performances in the summer of 1989 because he said it might offend Jewish theater goers. After the siege of Beirut in 1982, AIPAC, which is the chief Israeli, pro-Israeli lobby organization in this country, American Israel Public Affairs Committee, sent lectures around the country to demonstrate that the media had been anti-Semitic. That is to say, if you show pictures of what, in fact, Israeli soldiers were doing, Israeli tanks were doing, Israeli planes were doing, that was anti-Semitic. So the idea is, anybody who tries to say something is accused of Stalinism or of being a PLO stooge or even, worst crime of all, being an Arab lover. Epithets that are endurable if at the same time the evidence, the facts, and the figures are actually analyzed, debated, and rebutted. Most of the time these things aren't even mentioned. So viciously comprehensive has been the mode of personal attack on anybody who tries to speak out. Just smear the person, just discredit his or her character or history, and always avoid any discussion of the messy details. I can't say who's responsible for this state of affairs, but it surely could not have occurred without some calculation on the part of the Israeli lobby, which in 1988 alone spent over $3.8 million for congressional races, more than any other single issue political action committees. The Israeli lobby that ordinarily vociferous intellectuals would either cooperate or keep silent. In time, non-Jewish intellectuals and citizens were affected too, and all discourse about the Middle East began to conform to these obedient and servile modes, so that at the time when the National Council resolutions were announced in November of 1988, there was always, well, how do we know that they really gave it up? Are they still terrorists? All that stuff that had come from another world and from another concern began to infect even the discussion of a broader political reality. Nowhere was this more evident, in my opinion, than in the distastefully apparent wooing of something considered to be the Israeli lobby by presidential, congressional, and even municipal politicians. The result is a servility in U.S. foreign policy that I would like to convey to you simply by reading three titles given to a recent piece in the New York Times, late September, I think. The first headline, this is all the same article, the first headline, U.S. tells Israel it plans to sell Saudi's 300 tanks. Underneath that, Jerusalem's assent asked. Underneath that, Washington vows to address Israel's security concerns if deal not actively opposed. Breathtaking. I must note with respect and admiration now that because of the Lebanese War of 1882 and the Intifada, American Jewish intellectuals and other American Jews, non-intellectuals, began to speak up. Too often, however, they spoke up and were influenced by the habits of a generation. Instead of focusing, as I would have done, I like to think, in a similar situation as maybe all of you would have done, instead of focusing on the terrible abuses of human rights that were taking place on the West Bank and Gaza, the argument was that Israel's soul was being corrupted. And then as a few people began to talk about the need for reconciliation with the Palestinians, instead of saying, we should, after all, these are a people, we have to come to an agreement with them, Palestinians were described as a demographic problem. You've heard that one. As unflattering a notion as any that has emerged out of the rhetoric, ironically, of classical anti-Semitism. And adding insult to injury, Palestinians in the last year or so have been advised to change the charter, not to sing their national songs, to continue making unilateral concessions, while Israel kept proposing things as government policy designed specifically to delay and infinitely postpone the likelihood of peace. The Palestinian National Council decisions are central, as I said earlier, central Palestinian policy. Partition, 242-338, political negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians, secure boundaries, peace. Only Israelis who support this, the only Israelis who support this are inside Israel relative fringe elements in the population, because the government position is no negotiation with the PLO. In fact, as Abba Ibn said, it's the first time in the history of political conflict that one side in a political contest wants to choose the negotiators of both sides. The Israeli position is no PLO, no Palestinian state, no rights, no end to the occupation, no votes for the inhabitants of East Jerusalem in this business of the elections, and above all, no guarantee of political freedoms in the foreseeable future. The contrast, and this is the point I want to make in all of this, you see, in its rhetorical and real political setting, the contrast between the Palestinian and Israeli official positions is never made explicitly by the media on the one hand. I mean, I've watched many programs where they come and they go with Shimon Peres or Netanyahu or Ahrens. You know, they're on every Sunday practically. And, well, Mr. Peres, I remember once, I'm sorry to digress a bit like this, but I remember why, since as a professor of English, I'm interested in the uses of language. And I remember once, I don't know who it was, it may have been Peres, it may have been Netanyahu, it may have been, anyway. And they asked him a question. Of course, they never said, well, look, the Palestinians have said this, what do you say? They'd say, well, what is the Israeli position on whatever it was, elections or... And there issued forth from the mouth of this redoubtable Israeli spokesperson a string of, you have to take my word for it, I can't reproduce it for you, but it was pure gibberish. I mean, it was double talk. It was, you know, there was a comedian many years ago called Professor Irwin Corey who talked in what seemed to be like sentences, but they were total nonsense. And he said, well, a little bit of, yeah, we have this and we have to come back to the square one and 42 and 78. And yet nobody ever thought to say to him, but look, I mean, here's the Palestinian position. Why? None of that. Very few people took the even more advanced step of saying that as mainstream Palestinian political positions moderated, Israeli positions became more irrational, more extreme, and more unyielding. The differences between Labor and Likud were stressed, yes, but with a breathtaking dishonesty that didn't point out that it was the Labor Party in 1967 that began the settlements. Labor that cooperated fully with the Peace for Galilee 1982 campaign, and in the violent attempts to defeat the Intifada, it is a Labor minister, Mr. Rabin, who has been just as unflinchingly opposed to Palestinian rights as anyone else. Whenever Israeli demands were met, three or four more new ones suddenly made their appearance. The main contribution of the Reagan-Schultz era was to instill in all of Israel's supporters the discipline of, this is a new one in politics, don't pressure Israel, they'll come around in the end. And that usually meant give them more. On the very day in late 1987, the Intifada had begun, Ronald Reagan gently chided Israel for shooting unarmed Palestinian children. On that very day, an additional $280 million were given to our strategic ally. How much more aid, now set at over $3 billion per year, how many more apologies, how many more Palestinian lives are necessary, as in the lingo of political science, confidence-building measures, in order that Israel and its supporters may at last condescend to survey the damage. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to submit to you, therefore, that what Israel and its supporters, with the help of the United States, have done to the Palestinians is to punish an entire nation. It cannot be argued that fear and insecurity have in fact dictated a policy of denying hundreds of thousands of Palestinian school children an education by closing schools and universities for months on end. A sobering rehearsal of various categories of official Israeli behavior in the last 18 months deserves notice here. I quote from the table of contents of a book called Punishing a Nation, Human Rights Violations During the Palestinian Uprising, December 1987, 1988. Published by Law and the Service of Man, a Palestinian affiliate of the International Commission of Jurists, which is neither, by the way, the International Commission of Jurists, is neither a Soviet nor a PLO front. Ask yourselves, as you listen to the chapter headings, whether fear and insecurity warrant these things. Under use of force, we have statistics on death and casualties, the use of force in response to demonstration, live ammunition, plastic bullets, a policy of beatings, the practice of beatings, army brutality, use of rubber bullets, use of tear gas as a means of terrorization, harassment and destruction of property, army raids on villages and refugee camps, other forms of brutality, death squads. Under rubric obstruction of medical treatment, there are obstruction of health care, denial of medical services to population under prolonged curfew, attacks on medical personnel in the field, military raids on hospitals, etc., etc. Don't forget for a moment that these are carried out by one of the world's major military powers against an unarmed civilian population. This sorry list of items, documented, verified, attested to in the 475 pages that follow, goes on and on. It makes for unpleasant, even chastening reading. Do these infractions stimulate any massive public outcry in this country? No. Not if they are treated, if they are not treated as public in the public eye by public intellectuals. And not if, as is by now so customary, it is argued that because they had the temerity to resist Israeli practices, Palestinians actually deserve and are exclusively to blame for their half-century-long Calvary. And so it has gone. Whereas, in fact, Israel's war on Palestinian civilians under its military occupation costs $1 million a day, is subsidized by the United States, is kept in place and undeterred in its relentless, rationally planned and executed cruelty, because only a handful of Americans do not object, do not raise their voices, do not refuse to accept so dishonorably shameless a policy carried out, in effect, on behalf of the United States. True, things are beginning to change, but too slowly. A new pro-peace American Jewish lobby has been announced. There have been petitions, articles, protests. For example, the famous ad signed by a number of prominent American Jews, "Say No to Shamir." And also, some of the columns of Anthony Lewis in the New York Times, the one most recently published on Sunday, which described in horrific detail, I have it with me, I'll spare you the details, of how a Palestinian was systematically tortured and beaten by a number of Israeli soldiers. But accompanying such things, there remain public displays that are bloodthirsty and extraordinary in this country. Within days of each other in the United States, Ariel Sharon and the Lubavitcher Rebbe call for the abduction and death of Yasser Arafat. One should remember that to Palestinians and to the world, he was received, after all, as a state visitor by the President of France a few months ago, Arafat is a national symbol. To call for his death is no act of bravado or unnerving chutzpah. It is a direct consequence of the permission given and financed by U.S. policy to Israel's politicians, more or less, to do anything they want to Palestinians with impunity. I shall concede to you that the situation, and this is very important, that the situation in the Arab world is not something to boast about. The Arab states and their rulers are an appalling lot. Iraq massacres Kurds, the Lebanese liquidate each other, Syria bombs anything it can, and on and on. These and similar outrages take place in societies in which democratic freedoms have been suspended and in which incompetence and corruption rule pretty much unchecked and unchallenged. The revival of Islam, no less than those of Christianity and Judaism, have brought forth a ghastly procession of unbalanced clerics and frothing enthusiasts. No one of the various theocratic alternatives now circulating around in the Middle East is more attractive than any of the others. I will concede all that and more. If there were time, I could give it to you in lots of detail. But this in no way relieves us as Americans of our responsibilities and our positions. I think that the time has come to start with a common acknowledgement of the asymmetry in the power between Israel and the Palestinians, and second, We have to acknowledge that Israel and its supporters bear a major responsibility for the present situation of the Palestinian people. I cannot measure exactly how much responsibility, but that there is responsibility, not only for the past, but for the present, and by implication of the future, in all of which American citizens, Jewish and non-Jewish, play a privileged part, should no longer be stepped around. Despite the rhetoric of its victimization by the Palestinians, one of the good things in Friedman's book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, which I mentioned earlier, is the way he documents how, although Israel is a formidable military power, the image of the Holocaust, in a certain sense, has turned through a kind of ideological self-portrayal of Israeli society into the psychology and portrait of the victim. Despite the rhetoric of its victimization by the Palestinians, Israel is a formidable power today. As an Israeli intellectual has said, the military threat that a Palestinian state might pose to Israel is like Luxembourg threatening the Soviet Union. The basic question is how, as Americans, we relate to that power. The power of the state, of the lobby, of the status quo, and of the major organizations, major Jewish organizations, which I've heard many American Jews say to me, do not represent them at all. I don't think it's unfair to say that in the main, as Americans, we serve, but neither strenuously dissent from nor oppose this array of powers. And it's precisely this array of powers which has prevented the Palestinian Initiative for Peace, which has been so forcefully and for a long time insistently put forward. This has been prevented from being heard, servility to the powers that be. If one accepts the Israeli government line, the current Israeli government line today, one is in effect, as Potharet says it quite plainly in the New York Times on Sunday, one is in effect accepting an endlessly prolonged state of hostility, not only between Israel and the Palestinians, but between Israel and virtually all of the entire world. What such a future really means is a good deal less happy than can be herded under such phrases as Israel's security. It means, and this is, of course, what Palestinians have been resisting, the continued policy means continued repression of Palestinians. It means keeping up the distortedly high proportion of the Israeli budget that goes into defense. Before the Intifada, to take one small item, fewer than 10,000 Israeli soldiers did the job now undertaken by over 100,000. Add costs for new planes, tanks, submarines, and about 40% of the state's expenditures going to the military, and you'll get an idea of how expensive this policy is, a lot of which is subsidized by the United States. Israel's military needs will go on demanding more U.S. support, and as Anthony Lewis said in his column on Sunday, there's going to come a time when Americans are going to ask the question, what are we getting for this? Why are we continuing to pay for a policy that quite visibly is opposed to peace and reconciliation? So that as the demands increase, it doesn't need an Aristotelian intelligence to surmise that in time, and given the changes in public opinion that have been taking place in this country, dramatic changes over the last 5 years, USA to Israel is going to be reduced. I want to conclude by saying that Zionism in practice and in the Middle East has always been more honest than the varieties that have existed in this country. Ben-Gurion never made a secret of how he preferred an Israel at war than one at peace with the Arabs. It was better for the early existence of the state to be in a state of tension like that. If such a policy seemed necessary during the early years of the state, it has continued into the present with startlingly dangerous and even self-destructive ramifications. The idea that if Israel is in trouble at home or with the U.S., it can suddenly launch a diversionary preemptive strike somewhere is bad enough. that it does so with the illusion that the U.S. will always, as in 1982, cover Israeli deeds with its money and power, thanks to the lobby and its servants, is, I think, suicidal. The logic of military escalation is now thereby justified in an Arab world which is fully armed with a deterrent to Israel's nuclear capability. The name of the Arab deterrent is chemical and biological arms. With this logic in place, the social and economic consequences attendant upon full-scale militarism will be dreadful. The harshness and recklessness of Israeli actions today therefore appear quite bad enough without further intensifications in hostility of the overall environment. To encourage Israel in its present policy of sticking a boot in Arab faces is wrong. The resentment, the hate, and desire for vengeance that are being laid up in Arab and Muslim hearts, already dangerously full of passion, hate, and unfocused anger, is considerable. It is going to be difficult to forget or forgive years of Israeli insults and vindictiveness. To say that Israel is not alone to blame, or that there has been too much media attention paid to its treatment of the Palestinians, don't count as serious justifications of these policies. Again, the facts are that Israel is unique in its demand for an acquisition both of money and attention from the U.S. Neither Israel nor its supporters can one day ask for scrutiny of the heart-rending Jewish past as well as the dangers to Jews in the present, and then the next day, when Palestinians, as they have been doing for the last couple of years, claim the same right, it's wrong and immoral for Jews to say we shouldn't look too closely at either the Palestinian past or the present. Let's not worry about that. Let's think about the future. Palestinian and Jewish histories, I can't make this point strongly enough, Palestinian and Jewish histories, for the 20th century at least, are inscribed within each other. They cannot be separated, and they must be evaluated and acknowledged in moral terms, in terms of a future in which both peoples have the rights of survival and decent existence in a shared Palestine and shared in two modalities, entities or states. No less than Jews, Palestinians have achieved an undeniable and irreversible logic of national self-consciousness, which it would be and is, I think, ethnocidal to oppose. If I am right, then unqualified partisans of Israel's policy should declare themselves plainly and in the full light of day, either for the joint politically equal survival of two peoples, or they should say with equal openness that they feel Palestinians are and should remain less equal than Jews in Palestine or Israel. If the second option is chosen, then one can fight against it directly, as so many have fought against people like Rabbi Meir Kahana. If the first option, that is to say, that Palestinians and Jews have the right to sovereignty and a decent national existence on the land of historical Palestinians, then, as Americans, we can fight together on the same side. Lastly, the imperatives before us are an end to occupation, and even more important, some effective pressure on the U.S. government, which seems to waffle and come and go without any substantial change, some pressure by the U.S. government in order to modify and inform Israeli policy. The U.S. has the resources if it has the will to achieve such a goal. As Palestinians are being killed every day by Israeli soldiers, and as the Palestinian nation is being punished by the state of the Jewish people, punished but resists bravely and will continue to resist, our role as U.S. citizens whose country subsidizes the Israeli army, our role is, I think, to bear witness to testify against those crimes. It is also to provide embattled Israelis and Palestinians who have put forward, as I said, a genuinely fair and courageous peace initiatives. It is also to provide embattled Israeli and Palestinians who are for peace, to provide them with an alternative model to coercion and to an unending abrasive militancy directed against the region which, for better or for worse, Israel, in which Israel must try to survive humanely and appropriately. It seems to me then that the way before us is quite clearly marked. We are either to fight for justice, truth, and the right to tell the truth, or we should simply, quite simply, give up the title of concerned and humane U.S. citizens. I urge you not to give up. I urge you to move forward in this cause, which involves us all as Americans, as Palestinians, and as Jews. Thank you.
Break, and it will not be more than 10 minutes, and then Professor Saeed will take some questions and we'll have a little discussion going here. 10 minutes. Don't wander too far, please. I'd like to ask the people asking questions to speak directly into the microphone and to try and limit their questions to 30 seconds or a minute.
I agree with your comments for the most part. What I was curious about was the process you went through yourself in choosing to use the term Jewish lobby. I'm a Democrat from Massachusetts, and I've seen the effect of the Jewish lobby, say, on Kennedy, Dukakis, even Barney Frank. So I acknowledge its existence. I guess what I'm uncomfortable with in using the term is that it kind of goes also along with your inference of like how the American press coverage was not near as good, say, as Israeli press coverage, seemed to infer some kind of Jewish control over that as well. What I wondered was use of the term Jewish lobby, and then that say that the American press is not covering Israel well. I get a little concerned that we find ourselves backed up with, like, you know, Nixon was always like, you know, the left-wing Jewish press.
And right.
So that we end up kind of in a cyclical thing coming around to where
right.
they were.
Right. Yeah. I'm not going to... It's not necessary to repeat the question. I that's a good point. I would... Well, it's sometimes difficult to... make all the kinds of qualifications and distinctions that need to be made. I would say that what I'm talking about most of the time is the pro-Israeli lobby, which is largely, but not exclusively, dependent upon Jewish support in this, Jewish American support in this country. This isn't to say that there aren't pro-Israelis who are not Jewish. In fact, I mean, there are a lot of fundamentalist Christians in the South, for example, who are very pro-Israeli, and there are a lot of right-wing people, Jean Kirkpatrick, for example, who's also very pro-Israeli. So it's necessary to make distinctions of the kind that you just made. On the other hand, the phrase the Jewish lobby is often cited by journalists and others in public life as something that is intimidating and something that can threaten people, so that it's important for politicians to register support for Israel and to go through the motions of appearing to be concerned about what takes place in the Middle East, even though an election, let's say in Iowa, or the municipal elections in New York, for example, have nothing to do with the Middle East. As for the question of the media, I'm a bit puzzled as to what to say. I mean, there have been reports, most notably, for example, by Robert I. Friedman, who's written in The Village Voice and in Mother Jones, a series of articles about the way in which the pro-Israeli, and in fact, in some instances, Israeli officials are deeply involved in manipulating information in this country on the media, because they are present, because they have connections to many of the main networks, and so on and so forth. But I think there are other things that operate as well. I mean, I think there's a general laziness on the part of the media, which, you know, causes them to rely frequently on handouts. There is also forgetfulness, you know, that if a story... Look at the way people covered the abduction of Sheikh Ubaid in South Lebanon during the summer. I'm hesitant to say not a single one, but very few. I'd say probably no more than one of the or two of the many hundreds of commentaries, reports, editorials that talked about Sheikh Ubaid mentioned the fact that there was an Israeli occupation of a secure so-called security zone in South Lebanon of about 6 or 7 miles wide and 15 miles long. You know, so there is ignorance and there is forgetfulness and there is laziness. But when something that is thought of as being unkind to Israel, like scenes of the Intifada in which people are shown beating, armed soldiers are shown beating unarmed civilians, there is a policy on the part of the Israelis, and in the instance I cited with Kissinger and the leaders of some of the large American Jewish organizations, that's the way they're identified, to suppress pictures because that's thought of as harming Israel's image. Israel has historically, and this is the last point I want to make, Israel has historically relied upon good press for its success as a pioneer nation, democracy, and all the rest of it. And Palestinians have paid the price of this. And there's something a little disingenuous now about the pro-Israeli forces in this country mounting a big attack on the press. There's a convocation on Sunday in Boston on the 29th, which has Podhoretz and Ruth Wissa and a lot of people about, you know, the unfairness of the media to Israel. And the unfairness seems to me to consist only of pictures taken from what's happening on the West Bank and Gaza. So it's a complicated picture, and I don't want to minimize the complexity of it, but I think one has to be able to identify the characters as they identify themselves.
Thank you.
I'm sorry I took so long to answer that. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think that the U.S. support of Israel is a reflection of American racist tendencies, similar to our refusal to impose sanctions on South Africa or support the African National Council or implement United Nations resolutions?
Well, there are a number of factors here. I think that the support of Israel in the United States after World War II was thought of as part of the reparations and the reconstruction of the world after World War II. It was thought of as something fair and noble and just to the survivors of a people that had been genocidally liquidated by Nazism. And that seemed to me to be, you know, an understandable and positive thing. Of course, very few people at the time who supported the State of Israel in 1948, the founding of the State of Israel, realized or cared to realize that there was another people being displaced in the process. It's a very difficult moral and political issue. I'm not trying to minimize that at the outset. Later on, however, the support of Israel, particularly in the years since Reagan, or really since Nixon, has, I would say, been very essentially racist, in that Israel has portrayed itself quite consciously and has been portrayed by its supporters in this country as essentially a Western and, I suppose by implication, a white society in essentially a non-white, non-European, non-Christian world. And, you know, the fact that there are relationships revealed as recently as yesterday in the press between Israel and South Africa, that there are other conjunctures between Israel and some of the less savory regimes of the Third World, are part, it seems to me, of U.S. policy towards the Third World, which has historically favored dictatorships and repressive regimes, which Israel also supports. But the part that I find the most difficult to accept is that even in the case of South Africa, there is now a large U.S. constituency which makes it impossible for people to say a kind word about apartheid. And yet people still try to excuse what Israel is doing on the West Bank and Gaza. I think we have to apply the same standards, you know, to Israel that we do to South Africa. And as many Israelis have said, the conditions under which Palestinians live on the West Bank and Gaza are conditions that are exactly like, indeed are, apartheid. They are subject to unfair military rule. Settlers are allowed to do what they want. They're armed. The collaborators are armed. It's an immoral and profoundly wrong political situation. And the United States abets that by shedding a few crocodile tears from time to time. And by and large, the money that goes to Israel goes, unabated. And as Lewis said in the New York Times on Sunday, this is my last point, he said, when Israelis say, yeah, but look at the situation, or pro-Israelis say, look at the situation in Syria, or look at the situation in Iraq, look at the situation in India and Pakistan, Lewis says, yes, but they're not getting $3 billion a year from us.
In the event of a formation of a Palestinian state, I would imagine that most Jewish settlers on the West Bank would pick up and leave of their own accord, and so I'm not sure there will be much of a problem. Would you anticipate the same thing? And secondly, how has the Palestinian National Council treated this issue?
Well, it hasn't been treated, with any tremendous seriousness. Most of the time, the issues are issues of today and yesterday and maybe a little bit of tomorrow. But my own feeling, if you're asking me about that, is that as long as there's Palestinian sovereignty and a Palestinian state, then whoever lives there, like the settlers who now live in a kind of extraterritorial way without regard for the rights and the existence of another people, they will have to submit to those laws. I mean, that seems to me to be a decent and logical argument to it. A lot of them, as you say, I think would not want to stay there. But a lot of them, I think there's a problem there, because as the same issue of the New York Times on Sunday, it's quite interesting, there was an article by the editorial page editor, Jack Rosenthal, who described the way in which people in Tel Aviv, for example, are being encouraged to settle on the West Bank and Gaza, because not only because it's cheap and because, mortgages are inexpensive, but because there's an ideological reason for doing this. This is part of the greater Israel mentality. Now, how one deals with that is a great problem. I mean, it's not a problem I anticipate facing anytime soon. But it in terms of what's going to happen to these people. But it is a serious problem, and it probably will present problems. As for example, the inhabitants of Yamit, you remember in the Sinai, who as part of the Camp David agreement were forced to leave. They burnt everything that was there. You know, they turned over a waste. It's a serious problem in the future.
It's very interesting in what you said tonight, both for what you chose to present and also, unfortunately, what you chose to omit. I came tonight really looking for something called the Palestinian Peace Initiative, and the fact that you didn't address any such thing, unfortunately for me, just confirms that it's basically a contradiction in terms. As you spoke, I sat down and listed a number of things that I hoped you might have said in the interest of pursuing dialogue or pursuing a more balanced view of the situation. Some of them are comparatively minor. Your presentation of Joe Papp, for example, you don't mention that the following week he did turn around on his position and re-invite the...
No, he didn't. He said he would... I'm sorry to interrupt you, but can I just correct you?
Please. Minor point.
It is a minor point, but why not deal with minor points first and then get to the major ones later? He in fact said he would invite them at a later date when he could also get an Israeli play. That's what he did. and they were forced to put on their play at another theater. I went and attended it, and I was there, and I wrote him a letter, and I know everything about the situation. I mean, that particular situation.
You could also take the time to address. Again, I'm a little confused. Maybe again, I just don't know which exactly Arab states have decided to accept 242. This is something else that I'm not familiar with. The major points that I hope you do address, or the omissions that I saw tonight. You did mention the 800,000 Palestinians that were forced out of their homes in 1948. You didn't mention that they've been kept basically in refugee camps for the last 43 years, a majority of them not within Israel, but in Arab states outside of Israel, mostly for the Arab countries' political reasons. And two, you do mention the number, and I'm not sure what the actual number is, of Palestinians killed in the uprising, but by Israelis, but you don't at all address the issue of the more than 100 Palestinians who've been killed by other Palestinians, those that have been tortured, those that have been beaten. As Professor Said said, these are also documented. Many of these people, I understand, are labeled collaborators, but many of them also are just people that don't fit in. Prostitutes, drug dealers, or people just on the wrong end of the vendetta. I'm wondering if you could address these last two points.
Well, what were the points before the last two points? Come back again, if you wouldn't mind, to the microphone. I got confused. You had so many points you wanted to make. Oh, the 242. I'm sorry. Let me speak to that first of all. Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Egypt of the states, and of course all of the states of the Gulf have accepted 242. I'm sorry, I forgot what the other... Come and repeat your question, just that last part, the things that you want addressed. Oh, the refugee camps, yes. Just stay there, so if I need to ask you, I can... There's no excusing or prettifying the refugee camps. There's no argument that can be made for them. Each country is different. In the case of Lebanon, it was a conscious policy to keep the Palestinians apart from the other citizens of the country in camps. And there were problems faced by countries who I guess you would call underdeveloped, who were concerned about controlling populations with other political programs and coming from other states in a situation of turbulence and difficulty. And the refugee camps have, in my opinion, been an eyesore. I don't at all condone them. Most of them, however, have remained in what are largely poor countries. Countries like Lebanon, which is, certainly in a terrible state. In other places like Jordan, Palestinians have been integrated into the population and become Jordanian citizens. So it's not a uniform situation. But I think the underlying your question, if I may impute to you the goal, namely that the Arabs in some way are very responsible for the sorry condition of the Palestinians. I wouldn't say that. I mean, what really ought to be considered is why they were refugees and how they have become refugees. I mean, that seems to be the important question, A. And B, it frequently follows from statements about the refugee camps that the Palestinians should be repatriated in whatever countries they happen to have been kicked out to, in Lebanon and elsewhere. I mean, that seems to be a choice for Palestinians to make, not for you and I, for example, to just say that they should go stay in. You know, Israelis have frequently said, you know, there are 22 Arab countries. No. And fourth, I think, very important, there's no doubt that in the one place where Israel has had a direct hand in the condition of Palestinian life, that is to say, the West Bank and Gaza, the refugee camps in Gaza have gotten worse, more crowded. Areas that where Palestinians used to live were pacified and cleaned out by General Sharon in the early 70s. And Gaza now has, according to any number of international observers, the Red Cross, Amnesty, various European officials, and of course numbers of people from the United Nations, has among the worst conditions of life in the whole of the world. So, I mean, that is a direct result of Israeli policy towards Palestinians. I mean, the fact that the situation of Palestinians is not good in the Arab world does not, it seemed to me, excuse the situation of Palestinians under Israeli rule. And the point about them all is that Palestinians object to them all. I mean, that's the point, you see. Now, the question of the collaboration, it's very interesting because this is a new theme that is coming up now. And there are comments in the press, and Israeli propaganda makes a great deal of this. The number of fatalities by Israeli troops is much, much greater than any other kind of fatality on the West Bank and Gaza. Those people who are considered to be collaborators on the West Bank and Gaza are frequently, according again to the Israeli press, I have clippings here, I could read them to you, but I don't want to waste your time, are usually armed by the Israeli army. They are people who are given arms and money and cars and privilege in order to sow discord and dissension amongst the Palestinian resistance. The aim of the Israelis is to do whatever is possible to reduce the power and the sweep and the impulse of the uprising. And that includes planting informers, causing them to create issues between Palestinians, between villages, between clans, and so on and so forth. This is a classical tactic in all military occupation. As for the other things you mentioned, I don't really have any information on the prostitutes and so on and so forth, but the fact is, as a result of the Intifada, the drug problem on the West Bank and Gaza has been eliminated. It's a genuine insurrection in which there is a kind of unity in the ranks because there is a common enemy. And I think that is the way I would answer your question.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for your little quote from Ben-Gurion there. I thought it was kind of funny that no sooner should Ben-Gurion demand or express his wish that Israel should be in a state of war when the Arabs oblige him to invade. I only wish that Jews and Arabs could get along that well more often. You have a really good grasp of Palestinian history. You had a couple of blanks when it came to general Middle Eastern history. You mentioned the displacement of Palestinians in 67 and 48. You neglected to mention that in 48 the Arabs invaded Israel and in 67 the Jordanians invaded Israel from the West Bank. But I understand you have a limited amount of time, and in this space you had, you probably couldn't list all of the history of Arab aggression, both verbal and actual, against the state of Israel.
You know, when I was a beginning instructor, I was told that sarcasm is the lowest form of humor. So perhaps you could just save the sarcasm and make your point.
We all know his history as a friend of the Jews, etc., etc. On the other hand, we have...
You're failing again.
I'm getting to the point.
You're failing again.
But if you want to get to the point, I mean, that's what this is for, right? So if you let me get to the point, then you can respond. If not, I can just leave now.
It's a thought that's occurred to me, but go ahead anyway.
All right. We have the Tafada here now. In the Tafada, as you've seen, there are people being killed, not just by the Israelis. There are Arabs being killed, there are Jews being killed. I'm sure you're aware of that, I won't go into it. You say that they're unarmed, but we also see there are Arabs, Molotov cocktails, they have been found with guns, knives, rocks, etc., etc. This is documented, you may dispute, but I've seen other documentation. There are Arabs who are blocking roads, preventing other Arab workers from getting to work. So the point is now, this is obviously...
What is the point? No, because there's a military occupation and people resist military occupation. Do you accept that? Okay, I really think I got your point. In other words,
what I'm saying is, I personally, if the PLO showed, I have no...
I'm not talking about the PLO, I'm talking about the military.
If the PLO would show, hey, we'll stop the fight and the peace begin, you'll stop it, it has to go both ways.
Okay, all right.
Is not
no, it's not. But I mean, on the other hand, neither is military occupation. Next question. Right, exactly.
If peace talks ever do begin, probably the biggest thorn would be the issue of Jerusalem. because I couldn't see any political, any segment of the Israeli political culture willing to redivide it. In your opinion, would the PLO be willing to accept an agreement where East Jerusalem would not be regained, but the Arab communities in Jerusalem would get a significant degree of self-rule and autonomy?
It's a, as you said, it's a very emotional and volatile issue. You see, the point about Jerusalem is not simply that it's been united. I mean, I think that would be an inadequate and incomplete way of putting it. In fact, Jerusalem has been, it's true, united militarily. But in the process, large parts of East Jerusalem have been cleared of Arab inhabitants. There have been forced relocations of Arabs. Take, for example, Sharon's living in East Jerusalem forcibly at an enormous cost in security. I mean, he just does it to assert a presence. To Palestinians, generally speaking, I'm not saying that this is my position, you understand. I'm just saying in general, it's not as if there's a status quo, a united Jerusalem, and then let's accept it. There is the continuing deterioration in the Arab position in Jerusalem, which has to be addressed. And I think a more imaginative solution than redividing it, which is, in fact, as you correctly point out, the Palestinian and Arab position, would be some kind of special status for the city and some joint condominium for Israel and Palestine in the city, recognizing that both peoples have a significant stake in it. But I think the idea that as Palestinians we have to relinquish Jerusalem to autonomous community and so on and so forth is an unacceptable one, because it so obviously puts the Palestinian and Arab and Islamic and even Christian claims as a sort of second order to Israeli Jewish claims, which I don't think is acceptable. I think some perhaps illusion in the end of sharing and joint condominium is better than either redividing it or keeping it as it is right now. That's just my idea.
I have a question about points you made in your talk about the impact of Russian Jews going to Israel. But
yes.
First, I just want to explain my concern with this. I was brought up in a Jewish family and went to Hebrew school. And one of the things that I was taught was how during World War II in the 1930s, when the Holocaust was underway, countries like the United States, countries in Eastern Europe, could not admit the Jews at great cost to the population there. And how during the final Allied assault on Nazi Germany, Allied bombers did not bomb the railroad lines that were taking tens of thousands of Jews to the death camps, and indeed resulted in the extermination of probably several hundred thousand that could have been averted. And since that time, especially, Jews have been very conscious about the isolation of the world.
Right.
And particularly, I grew up with tremendous suspicion of the U.S. government as not really caring about the Jews. And one of the great ironies or tragedies of the situation is that anti-Semites like Richard Nixon become the major allies of a Jewish country, or South Africa, which are ruled by people who were imprisoned during World War II by the British because of their pro-Nazi views. Now, you mentioned in your talk that the Russian Jews are being diverted to the Middle East. What I have read in the paper, and I'd like to ask you to elaborate on that,
yes,
is that the U.S. government requested this of the Israeli government, that they were afraid because of Glasnost and freeing of immigration from Eastern Europe, that there would be influx of Jews to the United States.
Right.
In fact, as I understand, 85% of the Jews leaving Eastern Europe want to go to the United States.
Right.
And now what the U.S. was doing was going to prevent giving visas and admitting the Jews, as they did, perhaps.
In conjunction with Israel. I mean, there's an agreement between the United States and Israel on this very point, because the United States, as I understand it, doesn't want this influx here, whereas Israel does, you see. In other words, they used to be given a choice. They would go to places like Rome, and from there they could apply for a visa either to Israel or the United States. Most of them, of course, as you said, ended up by wanting to come here. And the new policy now, for which Israel is applying to the United States for money for housing, is for all of them to go ultimately to Israel, not to be given the choice Because there's this fear of too great an influx into the United States. Yes.
Well, sir, I have a question to you, and I guess I have a question to the people standing behind me who are staunch Zionists, and I am not a Zionist, which is, what has been the response of Zionist organizations to the exclusion of these Jews
from
the United States, recalling, in my mind, Roosevelt's policies of excluding the Jews?
Yes.
Has there been a call by Jewish and Zionist organizations to not treat Jews in a discriminatory way, unlike the way the Eastern Europeans, perhaps? If you're East German, I bet you get the United States real fast.
Right.
But if you're a Jew from that area, you can't. So my question to you is, if you know of Zionist or Jewish organizations that are working against this, and I ask the people behind me who I think were associated with Tagar, if they oppose this, and if they will work against it.
Well, I think it's a very, very, very good question. And to the best of my knowledge, I may be wrong. I don't have all the information that I should probably have. But my impression is that most of the Zionist organizations in America have not opposed this policy, partly because of the conjuncture of interests between the United States and Israel on this point. But where there has been, I should mention one thing that struck me. That is that Israel has been applying to the United States for additional monies to build housing for Russian immigrants coming to Israel. And it is the U.S. position that money should not be spent on the West Bank, building more settlements on the West Bank. There was a report in the Washington Post and the New York Times about 3 weeks ago in which, making it clear to the Israelis that soft money or money loaned for mortgages to build houses should not be used on the West Bank and Gaza, would in fact be granted if the undertaking was made by Israel. Israel will make the undertaking, but the reporters in both instances conclude this will free up money from the rest of the U.S. aid package to in fact build housing on the West Bank and Gaza. So it's a technical ruse to get more housing built on the West Bank and Gaza for Russian Jews. Given your preamble, the whole history of immigration for Jews, World War II and thereafter in the United States, it seems to me to be a perfect embodiment of the horrible history in which there is a kind of coincidence between classical anti-Semitism on the one hand and the suffering and the oppression of the Palestinians, who are kind of a third-order, sort of innocent bystander victims of this policy. Now, it's not their fault that they are in Palestine living as Palestinians on what they consider to be their ancestral land, but they are the ones who are going to be displaced by this policy. So there's a whole array of sort of cynicism and discrimination here, which has to be noted. But from my point of view as a Palestinian and as a human being who is totally opposed politically and ethically and every other way to discrimination of this sort, immigration discrimination, whether to prevent immigration or to force people to go to one place or the other, it's important to note that Palestinians are in the end likely going to be paying the price for this.
Just a comment.
But I think I would be interested to know what the position on the various large Zionist organizations, the ones who've encouraged immigration for Soviet Jews, on this very question is.
I just think it's a great tragedy that Russian Jews fleeing a society that's anti-Semitic would just assume the cab drivers in New York City and Chicago, and instead would be sent down to the West Bank.
Yes.
In a situation which they would just assume not be in, and be forced into a conflict with people that they don't know.
Yes.
And would probably learn to hate.
Yes.
I'm just going to intervene very briefly here. Professor Said is not going to be able to talk all night, and you can see we have a line behind the microphone. I just ask you, please, to be considerate of the other people behind you. Please make your question concise and to the point. If you want to follow up, if you want to argue a little bit, that's fine, but please try to keep it brief. Thank you.
Okay. This Tuesday, the New York Times reported that the recent discovery of, quote, a cache of detailed secret documents showing that the PLO is hiring local killers to assassinate other Palestinians, end quote. The Times points out that, quote, permission to kill people accused of working with Israel is supposed to come from PLO leadership, end quote. Mr. Said, you as a member of the PNC made policies such as this one for the PLO. How can you defend this policy of murdering your own people?
Wow. I don't make policy I read the article. It was on the front page of the New York Times yesterday. You didn't read further in it. And you didn't quote the latter part of the article, in which these documents were supplied to the New York Times by the Israeli consulate in New York. Do you have it there? Yes or no? Could you please read the sentence where it says, this was supplied to us by the New York Times by the Israeli consulate in New York? And they kept them for a month and then decided that they were verified. How they verified documents that was allegedly turned up in Gaza? I think, let me finish. You've asked the question. I'm trying to answer it. I think that this is a Mossad Israeli propaganda hoax to draw attention away from the continuing deaths of Palestinian children by Israeli troops. Last week, on Sunday, 8 children were killed in Gaza, one a 3-year-old and one an 8-year-old. The Thursday before, 13 were killed. Now, were they all killed children, many of them? Were they all killed by so-called collaborators, or were they killed by Israeli troops? This is the most nakedly patent and disingenuous ploy that in its long history of fumbling and dissembling Israeli propaganda has produced. That you should bring it here and presume to charge me with the murder of my own people is a scandal that you ought to be ashamed of.
Sorry, we've got to go to another question. Are you going to make it brief?
I'd just like to point out that the New York Times noted that the addressee...
The New York Times is available at the library. Everybody, it's available. So please, the next question, and again, keep it concise. We're probably only going to be able to get to 2 more questions this evening, and I apologize, but it's been a long day.
Mr. Said, from Yasser Arafat, who says he's renounced terrorism, comes this repeated response to a West Bank truce appeal by Bethlehem Mayor Elias Friedrich. Any Palestinian leader who proposes an end to the Intifada exposes himself to the bullets of his own people and endangers his life. The PLO will know how to deal with him, unquote. Immediately, Mayor Friedrich backtracked and went into hiding. Over the last several months, over 150 Palestinian people have been assassinated by their own. How, I must ask, is anyone supposed to believe that these barbaric murderers of their own people are willing, helping to, or willing to work for, excuse me, a viable solution?
I didn't understand the question. People are reading this volume. So I want to shut up and say it now.
First of all, let me say something.
This was a quote from the Washington Post of Yasser Arafat.
I'm going to go to Boston.
Now, let me just say something. I find it, speaking as somebody who's older than you, I find it extremely disheartening that you should be, first of all, reading something and reading it badly. This is a story that was discredited at least a year and a half ago. It was in January of 1988. It's not a recent thing. It was shown by the State Department at the time to be an invention. What Arafat said occurred after Frege withdrew, not before. There was a little problem of sequence, which you didn't, of course, note in what you read. Second of all, and much more important than whether it's true or not, it is part of the same effort as your friend and colleague who preceded you, to try to draw attention from the fact that 780 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli troops, that the announced Israeli policy of beating and more beating and the breaking of bones is a scandal which you find it very difficult to defend. Therefore, you go on the attack and you accuse Palestine, you blame the victims.
I have a
question to the letters. If not, I have other questions. If you care to comment on the letters.
On what?
We can move on. I don't care.
On what?
On the letters, the questions before about the cachet of letters and the... And the PLO killing.
I've said all there is to say. I mean, I don't think it's a subject worthy of discussion, really.
Okay, well then, I'd like to. I have two general questions I'd like to ask, and this is on the Palestinian state. The first one is, after 12 offers, more or less, this is from a book by Amos Alon, he cited 12 offers to Palestinians for a Palestinian state starting around 1948, what justification do the Palestinians as a people and also as Israel as a state have actually given them a state? And also my other question to this is, if they do agree, which seems that this could be plausible, to give them autonomy or a state, how would you suggest to go about this, under Resolution 242 or another means?
I'm not sure. I don't understand the last part of your question. In other words, I would say by an agreement between the representatives of the Palestinian people and of the Israeli people to negotiate an end to the conflict and to partition the territory, Palestine, into two states, West Bank and Gaza, into two states, an Israeli state and a Palestinian state. Now, I don't know where you get the figure 12 offers before 1948 that the Israelis made.
No, it's from 1948 to, I believe, 1967, I think was the last
right.
offer.
Well, I mean, look, retrospective analysis of this sort is interesting if it can be shown that once having turned down an offer, you're never entitled to it again. The fact is now that there is a new situation on the ground, that Palestinians have refused the solution proposed by Israel, which is endless occupation, and have said, let us end the state of insecurity and conflict between our two peoples, and let us have two states. That seems to me to be the urgent political meaning of the present moment. I can cite, based on the research of Israeli historians, I mentioned it in passing in my talk, the fact that that Israel has always preferred war to peace, and that on the one hand they make offers of peace and they turn out to be really invitations to further war. So, I mean, you know, take Israeli policy to Lebanon. I mean, that's pretty scandalous, and it shows a long history of interest in acquiring Lebanese territory, which Israel now possesses. But I'm not talking about that. I'm simply talking about the present situation in which, as I tried to show, there has been an important, momentous change in Palestinian political thinking and Palestinian political reality, which requires the acknowledgement of two peoples that they exist together as sovereign entities on the same but partitioned land. And it has to be done by negotiation. I think we better take the next question.
Can I just ask one quick follow-up? Do you think that the Palestinian people would want a demilitarized zone to at least protect Israel's national security?
You know, I mean, this is almost like Gulliver's Travels. What about the protection of Palestinian security? I mean, you know, Israel is the one with the army. I mean, I'm not a diplomat, I'm not a political negotiator, but let me just say this. I am for reduction on both sides of a Palestinian-Israeli border of military hardware. I am for a de-escalation of the conflict. I am for a demilitarization of Palestine and of Israel. Next question. Fine. And this may be the last one. Because my voice is just about finished. I can hardly...
First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming to Madison and giving somewhat of a pro-Palestinian viewpoint. We, the people on this campus who've been trying to portray this viewpoint, have been shot down by the pro-Israeli factions again and again and again. Just the recent occurrence of the Sister School Project, whereby tactics which are not even known to much of the university community were used to break this project that our international affairs coordinator tried to establish.
Father, you touched up on the subject of quote-unquote...
May I say something before you go any further, if I may, just on that point?
Yeah.
I want to say to those people in this audience who think that in stopping people from, in stopping the Palestinian point of view from being presented, in stopping people who want to encourage what in fact is a totally, in my opinion, benign cooperation between two universities, and who do so in what they consider to be the interests of the Jewish people or of Israel, there's something, I mean, I'm not a Jew, and I find it very, 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 I don't know, tragic is probably too strong a word, but it's disheartening and sad. This is a people who has suffered more than any other people in history. And that its cause, the cause of this people, should require silencing other people whose own sufferings are trying to be expressed. I mean, that is something you have to think about. What is going on? This is not a rhetorical point I want to make. I mean, it's as if, you know, that you lose if you are Jewish or if you're a Zionist, you lose somehow, your suffering loses its quality if you let in the proposition that other people have suffered, or more important, that you've caused others to suffer. It's an extraordinary distortion of humanity in a way. And I don't think people should be, I mean, like these young people who get up and say, well, Palestinians are killing Israel, and look at the, I mean, what is going on? There's a brutal military occupation in which more people have been killed. Palestinian civilians have been killed by Israeli military proportionate to the population than the entire number of people killed, Americans killed in Vietnam. We're talking about a comparable death rate of 60,000 people in the United States. And they stand up and say, what about the, instead of hanging your head in shame, people get up and say, well, what about that? He said that. It's indecent. That's what I'm trying to draw attention to. I'm not saying the right is all on one side and that there isn't another point of view and all that. Of course there is. But the fact is that there is only one military occupation in which an Israeli army is in military occupation, with settlers, is in military occupation of a civilian Palestinian population of 1.8 million. And that this part of the policy of this army is to break bones, to humiliate. That there is a paper, I have it with me here, and the Israeli army is entitled to slap women, to burn houses, to destroy houses, to punish school children for years, for 2 years, by closing the schools so that 300,000 school children are not allowed to go to school, to close down the universities, to ban books, to humiliate people, to search, to beat up, to put people in preventive detention where you're kept for months without knowing what you're put in jail for, in inhuman conditions, without water, in tents that are normally made for four people in which 70 people are to be put in the desert. How can anybody defend that? I'm sorry, but I mean, that seems to be the issue.
That made in the United States in your lecture.
Right.
For example, by certain institutions in New York, Washington, and so on and so on. And that this disinformation is oriented toward the American people.
Right.
The taxpayers of the there was a, at the initiation of the evening, there was a poster or a pamphlet that was distributed. I just want to read about two or three lines from it. It starts out by saying, PLO propaganda has deceived many people. Have you been fooled? Question mark. Number one, it goes on and says, perhaps you thought that the PLO would be willing to renounce terrorism. Then it says wrong. Number two, perhaps you thought that the PLO would settle for a Palestinian state alongside of Israel. Then it says, guess again. And then at the bottom it says, the PLO will stop at nothing short of the total destruction of Israel. Israel cannot be expected to ignore a death threat this obvious. America cannot afford to be fooled. Should the people of this campus realize that disinformation like this doesn't originate in faraway places like New York or Washington, but can and does happen in local communities like this one?
I can't answer that question. I don't know where it originates. I don't know where it originates, but it stinks. It sucks.
One more question. I'm very sorry, but we're gonna have to stop now. I apologize. Professor Saeed will be conducting a seminar tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. in the Wisconsin Union Theater. Thank you very much for coming out. Incidentally, you noticed that we had more questions than time to handle. The local press was called up about a press conference at 3 p.m. None of the television stations showed up. So you might give them a call if you're disappointed in the coverage of Professor Saeed's visit to Madison.